This is CliffCentral.com.
You know what show it is. You click the button on your phone.
And we are back.
We are back. I'm not dead.
I'm surprised you didn't get arrested at the airport, like the Tulsi twins, your cohorts.
My cohorts. they're going with the, it's not that we're innocent, it's just that your search was illegal. I see that's their defense at the moment.
A valid defense, but nevertheless, how was Syria?
Paris was great.
Oh, fantastic.
Supposedly, Syrian refugees on the streets, but you say they're not Syrian refugees.
No, they're gypsies. They're from originally from India 2,000 years ago, and no one can kill them off.
Great, because that's what we should be doing, killing them off. Okay, so now we started with such a light tone to the show. Freedom of speech, something we talk about quite often.
Yeah, it only works if it's against your enemies and not your friends, it appears, in this country at least.
Yeah, and also if we like what you're saying. I mean, we had previous guests on our show have had to endure some serious trolling recently because I don't want to get too involved in it. We can do it another time. But basically because they said something other people didn't like. And it had to be brought up and dredged through the mud. So, with that said, Mark Oppenheimer is with us. Mark is an advocate. Did I get that right? Anything else?
General troublemaker.
Yeah.
Explain yourself, Mark. What do you do? I mean, an advocate. So obviously, you just read lots of papers each day. But what are your special interests in terms of litigation?
So one of the things about being at the bar is that you get to deal with a variety of matters. So I spend a lot of time suing the city of Joburg. I basically say that my practice is built on state incompetence. So thank goodness the state doesn't do a good job because it keeps me in bread and butter.
So you're like a multimillionaire. Do you want to sponsor the show? We need a sponsor. Why not?
An advocate as a sponsor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look, we'll take money from most people, but not from lawyers. I mean, really.
Yeah, it's tainted.
Yeah, you know. And they're lawyers.
They always expect their pound of flesh.
Come on, Ramon.
I'm a legal consultant, not a lawyer, so it doesn't apply to me. But nevertheless, so Mark, I mean, we've been friends for a while now, and I understand that you are quite liberal on freedom of speech. Why should freedom of speech be something to aspire to, so to speak? Like, what is the relevance of it in a democracy such as ours?
So free speech is a foundational value. Without free speech, everything else collapses. It's important to be able to express your ideas in an environment without coercion so that you can challenge the existing status quo, that you can shout against injustices, that you can explore a range of innovative ideas in science, in the arts, in politics. You know, if the state clamps down on that or society clamps down on that, you're lost. And South Africa didn't used to be a place where you had free speech. You had a state-controlled broadcaster. You had very few papers. You had intimidation of journalists. Things that remind us of what's happening now.
Was this last year? Oh, you're talking about apartheid?
Sure.
Oh, no. Sorry.
But hard to tell the difference.
And every day.
Yeah, and every single day. Well, yeah, the point of free speech is holding power to account in a way for me. Because every single aspect of what we call liberal rights now, gay marriage, things like that. If you spoke about that 50 years ago, you'd be sent to prison or disbarred from your job or whatever the case might be. But
not even 50 years. So right. Gay sex was illegal in South Africa until 1993. In the States, until more recently than that. You know, it took a challenge in the Supreme Court to go and challenge that kind of thing. So, and one of the ways that you change minds is by expressing your ideas freely. So I think one of the reasons why there's been such acceptance of gay marriage in the States is because there's art that deals with gay love and that people are exposed to that and they can think and they can change their minds. You know, speech often starts off feeling very uncomfortable and repugnant and people say you can't say that, it's offensive, it's pornographic. Mm. And then they get exposed and they think about it and they debate it and their views shift. you know, often for the better.
What about the argument, you know, our listeners often want us to speak to the other side. What about the argument from the other side that if you've got this kind of identity politics stuff, if you've got power, then your sort of speech should be limited. We had Pierre Defosse recently commenting on this UCT debacle, which I'm sure we can get into. Mm. But the problem I had with what he said and Justin from McCarthy from our last podcast actually wrote some good stuff on this. He ventured into the identity politics thing in basically saying, why would you invite this person to speak? You need to think about who you invite to speak on a campus, because essentially people with power should have less right to speak now than people without power. So can we just go into why that is bullshit?
Absolutely. So I think one of the amazing things about current technology is that the level playing field has shifted so much. So often it's those that feel powerless and might not have money or might feel from their marginalized community that are able to punch far above their weight because they can jump online, you know, they can grab that loud hailer. And
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, sure. You're talking about a small group of people who can say something that's dramatic and they can garner a lot of attention. So I think the idea that, you know, in a society where you've got a small number of newspapers and that's your only channel for expression, the idea that there are big imbalances of power in the marketplace of ideas might hold weight. That's no longer the case. I think it's very easy for people to express their ideas. And given that there is this balance of power, we need to allow everyone to speak. And then what we do is we rebut them. It's also important to point out, though, that the regressives who hold these quite repugnant ideas and are a small minority and want to silence others, we need to point that out in speech. Not by removing their platform and saying, you know, you don't get to participate anymore, we don't like what you're doing. Sure. You can do that once they start doing violence, you know, abhorrent things. But when it's merely speech, then we must allow it and we must allow them to be foolish.
We fight speech with speech.
Exactly. And there's a fantastic example of that now. So Ayanda Mabula, who I think is a national hero in South Africa, paints a series of depictions of Jacob Zuma, the latest of which is utterly fabulous. You know? You've got
it's him rimming Atul Gupta, I think.
Yes. And they're both in the cockpit of a plane. And they've got their hands off the levers, and they're about to fly into another plane. And there's the ANC flag in the background.
Yeah.
And you can see this is the sort of situation that South Africa is facing, right? It's a great way of having politics and art merge.
Well, it's a metaphor for the country as a whole.
And so you have this outrage in the sense that, you know, we've got to respect power. We've got to respect these, you know, authoritarian figures like the president or elderly men or whatever it is.
Mm.
And so that, you know, the family gets upset and our dignity has been impinged. And one of the things that when I saw this sort of attack, and there was attacks to try and, you know, take him to court and remove the painting, things that happened with the spear, and immediately I broadcast to my friends, listen, lawyers, we need to unite. We need to provide this guy with protection because it's important to allow this kind of speech to be out there. And then today, there's this fantastic bit of counter dialogue. So there's, a painting of Helen Zille and Mamuzi Mamane and James Self, and they're all in the nude and sort of shown in some sort of degrading stance. And what are
degrading's a look? The rimming is equally, yeah, I suppose. So just to describe it, if you haven't seen it, it's essentially I think James Self and Helen Zille on a Oxwagon cart, both of whom are naked. Helen Zille with legs spread wide open. There's an image for you guys. Then Musi Maimane is pulling the ox cart, essentially. He's also naked, and obviously the genitalia of everyone are, you know, quite visibly shown. So that's the description.
So if you want to fight fire with fire, do that. Paint isn't going to hurt anyone besides some feelings.
Yeah.
And you don't have to endorse the work either. So
isn't it an interesting study, though, in like in the reactions of the different sides? So maybe I'm incorrect, but To the spear, there was this massive reaction. We had a city press editor essentially self-censoring. She's subsequently been called essentially, you know, the second Madonna, since she's resigned for all other things she's done. But I think that will be a tarnish on her reputation.
Something she admits freely. So Ferrell says that was one of the worst decisions she ever made.
Yeah.
And she regrets it and she was under enormous pressure.
Cool. So at least it's an admission of a fault and cool. We can then move on from it. But we had that. We had demonstrations outside the gallery, which were not quite peaceful in a way. We had eventually the art was destroyed. The artist, Mr. Mabula, that you're talking about, he has also, I think, faced quite a lot of scrutiny and a lot of criticism in the public sort of domain. This painting gets released on the other side, doing exactly the same thing to the opposite team, essentially. And I haven't seen much of the, we have to stop this, we must destroy this art.
No, but I received the best response on Twitter today. So I made a series of tweets about, I can't wait for Zwelinzima Mavavi to be outside.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Kenny Kunene's house, who bought this painting of the DA, to be outside Kenny's house and to protest. I can't wait for the Films and Publications Board to rate this painting 18, as they did for the Sphere. Yeah. I can't wait for all of these things to happen. And then someone with an ANC logo, AVI, on Twitter says, no, dude, it's freedom of speech. Literally, that's what they told me. I said, oh, delicious. But, yeah, the lack of reaction is quite amusing.
Very
to
telling.
Me.
So I think it's important, as a liberal, you actually have to care about that abstract value and you apply it uniformly. Mm. What you'll find is that regressives don't. They don't care about universal rights and principles and applications in an equal manner.
This is a difficult thing, though. We were chatting off air before, and I think in general with regards to freedom of speech, people find it difficult to apply it uniformly. I think it takes quite a mature approach to let someone you don't particularly agree with or you dislike or who hates you, who openly hates you, say things that you feel are terrible. It takes quite a mature approach, as I said, to kind of get there. We used a specific example around, you know, anti-Semitic stuff, questions around whether it is or isn't, but often it's stuff is shut down with that as the reasoning. And I would argue that sometimes I think it could be shut down prematurely because, you know, we want to shut down what is seen as hate speech, and we can get into hate speech as well. So I do think it takes quite a mature sort of progressive. I don't know who's progressive anymore, but quite a mature progressive approach.
I'll tell you one of my favorite stories. So about a week around the time of the spear, okay, a painting comes out of Stephen Harper, the then Prime Minister of Canada, and he's depicted in the nude with a dog on his lap, okay, but his genitals are fully shown. And so the Office of the Prime Minister releases the following statement. They say, Stephen Harper is outraged by this painting. It is completely a falsehood, and everyone has got to know that this is not an accurate representation of Stephen Harper. He is not a dog person. He's a cat person.
Seriously? Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
That's what they said.
And that's the way you deal with it. You laugh it off. You know, everyone says you can take a knock on the chin in style, you know, and that's how you respond. And I think one of the problems that we have in South Africa is that people are so fragile when it comes to speech. We immediately rush to saying, silence it, stop it, you know, my pain, my angst, as opposed to sort of dealing with things with a little bit of humor. You know, Zapiro is one of those guys who's for such a long time been really good at, you know, helping South Africa look at things with a funny lens. Mm. And it was devastating for me to see someone like that cowed by all this pressure, this intense pressure to say that you need to repent. Yeah. And I think one of the things that's important, so I'm from a philosophy background, and when assessing arguments, we take this approach that you are as charitable as possible with your opponent's arguments. So if your opponent gives a bad argument for a position, your job as a good philosopher is to buff it up, to turn it into the best possible argument. So you're charitable in your approach. And that way, that when you're jousting with the argument, you're not jousting with a straw man. Mm. You're jousting with something of substance. Mm. And I think when we relate to each other, it's important to be charitable in our approach. So to understand someone's words in that charitable light. Look, you know, if someone is saying, you know, I'm coming for your land and I'm going to come and hunt you down and kill you and I want to exterminate you, you know, I don't know how much charity you can have. He's being clear about his principles. You can ask and you can say, what about this and what about that? You can try and get a sense of the position. But I do think it's important for us to not assume the worst of each other when we dialogue.
Well, I think that's what the progressives do, right? They look at a tweet and immediately call it racist or sexist or whatever other word they want to use.
Yeah.
But what do you think about freedom of speech in terms of the so-called so like comedy against so-called oppression minorities? Mm. So for example, a good example of this would be Caster Semenya, right, making fun of her and her biology. It's freedom of speech. I mean, do you think it should be less regarded because she's a minority? Well, not, I don't know about persecuted minority, but excuse me, but a minority nevertheless. Do you think
so? There's been this move to try and redefine
how
what
is she a minority? Is. Just so we are clear on that.
As an intersex person.
Oh, but she doesn't claim to be.
Well, biologically she is, I think. But okay, say trans people, fine. Trans people, they are a minority. They like to commit suicide quite a lot. Is it fine to make fun of them? Or
you're dropping the bombshell today.
Well, they do. 40% suicide rates.
Anyway. I know. All right, sorry.
So there's been this move to say that satire is about critiquing the powerful.
Yeah, punching up.
Yes, you must punch up and you can't punch down. That's not a traditional understanding of what satire is. Satire has traditionally been about poking fun at the foolish. And the foolish may be in positions not of power. And I think it's important to have that freedom to, you know, to laugh and to jest. We don't have to like all speech to allow it. So someone can crack a joke that we think is incredibly offensive. And we don't like it. We think it's emotionally hurtful. That doesn't mean we ought to have a criminal sanction for it. So, you know, if someone wants to target a minority group in a way that's hateful, call them out for being hateful with counter dialogue. But, you know, there's no need to go and, you know, call for them to be, you know, removed from their employment, to be dragged through the mud, you know, to be physically assaulted, to be tossed in prison, to be fined 150,000 rand in an equality court. You know, you can point out why speech is offensive. You can try and engage in a dialogue with someone. You can try and work out what they mean as well in a sort of way. But I don't think you ought to grant particular exceptions because someone is from a minority group. But I think what we ought to have a proper discussion about is, what is this hate speech thing?
Yeah. So before you go there, we mentioned on a previous show with regards to hate speech, you know, our constitution makes freedom of speech a very important priority. And then we subsequently have the Equality Court and sort of legislation.
Yeah, the Equality Act, I think it's called.
Yeah, the sort of acronym for it is PAPUDA, the Promotion and Protection of Equality.
Right.
Yeah, so we have this, we have that act, and we have the Equality Court who sort of oversees this and deals with the justice around that, I would assume. But when I read through that, it seems to take hate speech too far. So it makes freedom of speech a bit of a joke, in my opinion. So from your perspective, both on as a heavy free speech advocate and as an advocate, give us a bit more.
I think the first thing to understand is that we have a supreme law of the land in this country, and that's the Constitution. Okay. That legislation is subordinate to the Constitution. So if there's an inconsistency between an act and the Constitution triumphs. But often in order to show that, it has to be tested in a court. What's interesting about the Equality Act is that when it deals with restrictions on free speech, it does so in a broader way than what the Constitution says. So first I'll just have a brief statement about what the Constitution says. So it protects all sorts of speech. It talks about artistic speech, freedom of the press, a wide ambit of political speech as well, and then places three restrictions. First is no propaganda for war. Okay. The second is if speech constitutes an incitement to imminent violence, not protected. And the third is that if it's advocacy of hatred on one of four listed grounds, which is race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and it constitutes an incitement to harm.
Mm.
So it drops two things there in that last bit. So it's harm, not violence, and the imminency requirement is reduced. So the classical liberal approach wouldn't have something like that requirement. It would stick at B, which says that you've got this incitement to imminent violence.
Mm.
And that's the case when you restrict speech. So a classic example is you're upset with factory owners. You say factory owners are exploitative and they take advantage of their staff, and we should rise up and do something about it. So the liberal position is that's a perfectly acceptable idea to express, but it matters where you express it. So if you express it in a newspaper, there's no threat of imminent violence. If you express it to an angry mob holding pitchforks and lighters outside of a factory, there's a very good chance that that'll lead to the factory being burnt down. In that situation, we might want to limit speech. Or in Rwanda, when you've got calls for people to go and, you know, burn down their neighbors' houses and chop them up into little pieces, and people are doing it, there's good reason to not protect that speech and to block those radio signals. Now, what the Equality Act does is it enlarges the framework. It doesn't just talk about harm. It talks about hurt, so emotional hurt. It also enlarges the categories of people that get protection. So section
– sorry to interrupt, but that last category, which is based on race, gender –
ethnicity and religion.
Ethnicity and religion. The important part, I think, is what people read is the first sentence and then leave out the second sentence. Because I've often, in sort of arguments around freedom of speech, people go, but you can't have freedom of speech that harms those four categories, that aims to sort of harm those four categories. But the second part of that sentence is and. What's the sort of wording?
Constitutes an incitement to harm. So let me explain. Let me unpack that a little bit. So there's a distinction to be drawn between hateful speech.
Mm.
So I say hateful things about you or about a particular class of people. So
fuck
I use racial.
Fuck all white people.
Yeah, fuck all white people. Okay. Or, you know, white people are dirty dogs, something like that, right?
Yeah, cool.
Now, an incitement implies that what I do is I call upon third parties to invite harm upon the targeted group. So I say, white people are dirty pigs, and you know what we need to do to pigs? The same thing we do in slaughterhouses, okay? Mm-hmm. Slit their throats. So I say that there's a call to action, which is going to result in a harm.
Okay.
So that's where you have the restriction. So merely hateful speech is protected, at least in terms of the constitutional order. So we think that's an odd thing, right? Why would we allow hateful speech? There's a couple of good reasons. The one is, it's important to know in your society who holds these hateful views, that you can point them out. You can say, oh, that guy is a Ku Klux Klan member. You know, look at him in his white hood. You know, and then you can decide how you want to deal with them accordingly. Mm. Not that you invite, you know, harm upon them, but you might not want to do business with them.
But they're good examples of the case of – I don't want to get the naming wrong, but the guys who had that sort of conspiracy to blow up a whole bunch of things across South Africa.
The brutal one.
Yeah, there you go. So, sorry. Didn't want to get it incorrect. The reason, from my understanding, is the reason they were kind of caught out is because these were people who were known to have these kind of views, because they had made these views public through their speech. So they were being watched for that reason. And in the end, that resulted in, it averted essentially a catastrophe.
Sure.
Because they would have blown things up and hurt people.
But not everyone that expresses a hateful view is going to go and try and blow up a building.
No, absolutely. I'm just saying they were allowed to have the speech, but what was stopped was their action afterwards from kind of whatever they were planning, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But they were allowed to have the speech. And if they weren't allowed to have the speech, then we may never have known that they were having these thoughts, and we may not have stopped them. Sort of my attempt at one example of showing where...
Well, we drive dangerous ideas underground then.
Mm.
So it feeds into that. So they say, you know, the state won't allow you to express the ideas because they're afraid of them. They must be true. They must be good ideas. You know, the thing about bad ideas is when you put them, you know, in the light of a marketplace and people get to interrogate them, you can see them for what they are. You can see that they're bad ideas. And so hateful ideas don't last very long when they're allowed to be exposed. That's one thing. The other one is that there's a distortion in language that happens. So Stalin was very good at being able to censor all sorts of text that are political content by mislabeling them. So he'd say, this is pornographic. And no one likes pornography. No one wants to stand up for pornography. No one likes anything that's racist. So, you know, when you have a movement saying Zoom must fall, you call it racist. People say, oh, well, we can't allow racist speech. And so when you allow for that kind of mischaracterization of things, it silences critiques. It has this chilling effect, and people feel that not only is it not protected, but there might be a criminal sanction or a financial sanction. I better not say anything. That's very dangerous. So it's important that we allow for things on this spectrum of that may be considered hateful. We can interrogate them, but not all of them are hateful. Not all of them are racist. I think we've got this troubling time in South African history where we've got a neo-McCarthyism. So under McCarthy, people kept lists of, you know, who was a member of the Communist Party, and they were blacklisted, and they were shunned, and they were kept out of employment. People were told to rat on each other. You had these proper witch hunts for it. I mean, it's sort of, there's a play written about it comparing it to Salem witch trials. And we've now, instead of calling people communists, we now call them racists, even if they're not necessarily so. But it's such a powerful word. It's the card that keeps on giving, you know, and the problem is that we allow it to be that. So, and when it comes to political discourse, the best way to get someone to shut up is call them a racist.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us
to... people get mad when you don't respond to that. I think Ramon and I are relatively good examples, because neither of us give a shit about being called racist anymore. Because it's lost all meaning, frankly. Firstly, when you aren't, it doesn't have meaning to start off with. But the other thing is, every time you say something, people just react to it in that way.
Well, I mean, someone told me once, the best thing, in air quotes, about being called a racist, you can only be called it once. And you know it's not true, so it doesn't matter what people call you anymore. And this particular person wears the racist mark with pride, because he's not a libtard, so to speak, in his own words. But there's also something more insidious about that, is that the Constitution was promulgated to stop state censorship. But okay, the state is worrying me with this new racism legislation they want to put up.
But, and the SABC.
Yeah, but that was always a fuck.
Always up. A government issue.
Yeah, no, it's reached its final form and people are fucking surprised. Get over it. Anyway, but what's more insidious is censorship from other members of society that you live in, especially on social media. And there's nothing really to protect against that, in a way. Unless you use maybe defamation laws if you really want to. But there's nothing really to protect you from just a mob telling you that you're racist for misrepresenting your argument.
So I think what we need to do is, you want to change the way the discourse happens in the public. So, like I talked earlier about having a charitable approach, it's important for us to sort of grow thicker skin, to realize, to internalize how important that value of free speech is. So even though I don't like being called this, or you don't like that I've said this, we need to be a bit more accommodating with each other. And that's one way to sort of deal with the social media mobs, is try and inculcate these values. I think it's important for liberal voices in particular to speak out and point out how important these principles are. And I think we're at an interesting time at the moment. So when Max Price cowardly withdrew the invitation to the, you know, the cultural editor of Yildiz Postens, you know, he sort of did it in this weaselly way. So he starts by saying, you know, the university cares about academic freedom and we care about, you know, free speech. And he cites a little bit from the Constitution. And, you know, then he says, well, because we think there's a threat of violence, we're not going to allow it. And because this guy is being called a homophobe or an Islamophobe, you know, even though that's a contested idea, we don't think we should have him on our campus. And so what you have is wonderful liberal thinkers like David Benatar saying, hold on a second here. The threat of violence is not coming from him. He's not going to incite anyone to cause violence. We are being held hostage by others who are threatening violence against us. We're giving them the assassin's veto. If they don't like anything that we do, all they have to do is threaten violence. And so if you allow a culture like that, anything can be shut down. That's not what's enshrined in our Constitution. It's important to stand up against those guys. And so when Benatar speaks, he's then joined by other members of the philosophy department, brave people like Eliza Gulgut, who also point out this isn't the only thing that's happening at UCT. So you've got an art censorship committee. They've taken down 79 works of art that are on campus on the grounds that they might hurt people's feelings. You've got people burning works of art on the campus. It's important for people to realize that this horrible stuff is happening, that the space for free speech is vanishing rapidly. And unfortunately, it's happening in the places where it ought to be burning the brightest. You know, instead of burning paintings, you should be burning, you know, people should think of ideas in a bright way. And our campuses have become these awful places where people are frightened. They're, you know, they're full of fear.
Why do you think it is that, you know, you've got, you mentioned some names in the philosophy department who have, quite frankly, been the only bright light at UCT for some time now.
But the rest of the departments seem to just capitulate, the entire executive and council or Senate. In fact, the committee that invited Fleming Rose, the chair of that committee, who's Jacques Rousseau, who wrote a piece on this, isn't seemingly brave enough to stand up to his vice chancellor and say, this is bullshit. Stop doing this. Stop censoring. We're going to have this. I mean, the vice chancellor of a university is not the be all and end all. A university is a relatively democratic space. I cannot understand why it's just so accepted. It's become an accepted norm, this sort of limitation, what you're talking about in terms of taking down art. These things are becoming the norm, the habit of our society, in which you're just not allowed to say certain things. And if you object or say anything, you are so in fear of being shunned that most people just don't. And so liberals, who, for example, I think Jacques at heart is, are acting very illiberal.
So I'll give you an interesting take. So UCT, the Senate, took a vote on whether or not to remove the Statue of Rhodes.
Yeah.
So 100 senators vote, 99 votes in favor of removal, and one abstains.
Yeah. I discussed with the GAD said, actually.
So I said to Jacques, who's the guy who abstained? And he refused to tell me, and I said, why? Why would you tell me? He said, well, if it was known, that person would be hounded. They would be torn to pieces by the rest of the people on campus. So now that tells me something very important, which is that the 99 who supposedly voted freely were not free to vote. It's a coercive environment. I mean, there's many reports of bottles being thrown in the meeting.
If going against the grain, then...
You know, there's another great example of 99% of people voting for something. It was the Anschluss in Austria when Hitler marched in. 99% of people voted for it, you know. We must be very suspicious when there are small degrees of dissent. Yeah. That it's so unlikely that everyone agreed. Mm. It's much more likely that there's something else going on. So it's important to have dissenters on campus. You know, I think when we talk about diversity on campus, we think about diversity of race or gender. We should think about diversity of ideas.
Yeah, well, actually, that's the only diversity, in my opinion, that ultimately matters.
Well, you must read Jonathan Haidt on this. Do you know Jonathan Haidt, Mark?
No.
He's a philosopher.
Columbia.
In NYU, I think. And he talks about diversity on campus as well. And he wrote a great book called The Righteous Mind, which I highly recommend that you read. And he says, yeah, I mean, if you look at the ratio of conservatives to liberals in the US in social sciences and the humanities, it was 4 or 5 to 1 20 years ago. Now it's 10, 12 to 1. 12 liberals for every conservative.
Means something very different in the States.
Right, it's the progressive left, the Bernie Sanders.
No, liberal is not classical liberal.
No, it's the progressives, right? It's the Bernie Sanders voters. But here we're obsessed with race quotas, but not ideological quotas.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, Thomas Sowell, who's a black guy, probably one of the most brilliant conservative, classically liberal minds in the world, yet he's black. So, I mean, he will follow a racial quota, but ideologically he's different from 90% of
the
electorate.
It's an amazing thing that just because you happen to have a certain color skin that you don't think a particular way.
How dare you say that?
All right, so we've still got to get to the Equality Court, but let's get into the sort of stuff that happened to you recently on that point. Because you go down to Grahamstown.
Yes, so Grahamstown has this incredible arts festival, and in addition to all the beautiful music and dance and drama, they have something else called ThinkFest. And so ThinkFest is run by someone called Anthea Garman. She's a journalism lecturer at Rhodes, and they have a series of different topics, and they have panel discussions. And the idea is that it's a place for curious members of the public to engage with these ideas. And so I went to a particular talk on free education. Now, free education is a burning concern for us. I went to another talk this morning with Jonathan Janssen on it. We clearly have some sort of crisis, and we need to decide, is free education financially viable? Can we afford it? If so, where are we going to raise the money from? Should it be for everyone? Should it only be for the poor? You know, if we have free education, aren't this in a bit of a sop to wealthy students that could afford to be there on their own? From what I gather, the estimates on what it would cost would be something like 150 billion rand.
We can do free education. We just can't keep the quality.
So, sure, you have that problem
so you
too.
Can you can do free education, free tertiary education, and you can just drop the quality to crap.
And it'll be worth exactly what you paid for it.
Exactly. So, but yeah, carry on.
So, anyway, so I went to this talk, and the panel is sort of stacked with guys on the far left who, you know, who don't want a reasoned discourse about, you know, how are we going to pay for this, or where's the money going to come from, or acknowledging that there are trade-offs. And so I, you know, paused to ask a question. And you can listen to what happened.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to play you the entire segment now of that discussion. And then when it's done, we'll come back and talk about it.
Yeah. And try not to vomit, please.
I'd like to ask two brief questions.
Your name, sorry.
It's Mark Oppenheimer. The first is, yes, from the Oppenheimer family who have oppressed most of the people in this room.
Probably, I don't think you have a right to speak. You do not 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 have a right to speak. And you will not speak. 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 You are not going to speak. Put the keep past the mic. You're not going to speak. Your presence here.
I'm sorry to upset you, Lindsay.
Keep that mic
please,
away.
Leave the room if you're upset.
No, I'm not going to leave.
Don't make me come over there. Give that mic. Give that mic over. Give that mic over. You won't speak. I promise you, you won't speak. You will not speak. You are not going to speak. You will respect us. You are not going to speak. You are not going to speak.
Lindsay, we can do this all day if you want.
Yeah, we can.
You can tell people that
we can do
speak,
it. We can do it all
or
day.
We can proceed.
You're not going to proceed.
You can't tell us here that, oh my God, sarcastically. Give up our mouth by
your
family.
I got your point. Sorry. Hello.
At that?
Excuse me.
Seriously.
Yes, okay. Do you want to make a point? Do you want to say something?
This is what we have to live with every single day.
All right. Can you look, just allow somebody to speak, please?
I think we have to respect the supreme law of the land, the Constitution. Everyone has a right to speak, and we will not, we cannot allow a situation where someone is denied an opportunity to participate in a discussion. There's freedom of expression, freedom of thought, and therefore, Judge, I think it is completely unacceptable to deny someone a right to participate in this discussion.
Okay, wait. Can I interrupt?
Yes.
You want to say something? I'm just taking over, Dennis, if you don't mind, for
right.
a moment. Okay.
Can I?
Yes.
All right.
Okay. Look, you know, ultimately, ThinkFest is my responsibility. I'm the convener. The Legal Resources Center has been a partner with us for many years, and we've tried to put on the agenda some very important conversations. Okay. What I do want to say is that I think we can't just do the Constitution allows every single person to speak and say whatever they like. There are certain spaces in which that is possible, and there are certain times in which that is possible. We are not in one of those spaces right now. And we are not in one of those times. That's my opinion as the convener of ThinkFest.
Which means?
Which means that we can't just go because the way things are said has massive import. So what we are being told, I'm sorry, this is an intervention and I'm trying very hard to think quickly on my feet. What we are being told is that this is not just a white person with an opinion. This is not just a black person with an opinion. This is just not an activist with an opinion or a VC with it. Our opinions are not equal here. They are embedded in our histories and in our exclusions and in our racist positions. Okay. So I think what we've got to do, whether this man speaks or he doesn't speak, what I'm trying to do is recognize what has been going on right now. Okay? And I think when white people speak, they take advantage of the fact that the Constitution allows them an extraordinarily huge amount of privilege to continue to obscure. Okay? Am I hearing this correctly? Okay. So I'm sorry, but it is the case that what you're going to have to do right now is own the fact that you tried to sidestep your name and what your name means in this space. Okay, so I just want to, I don't want to take over and stop the conversation, and I don't want to actually even make the decision, because I don't know what the right decision is going forward. I just don't know what it is.
Are you telling
but
me,
I am saying...
are you saying you want to close the entire conversation?
No. I'm not saying that. I'm going to throw it back to you. I'm going to throw it back to you to make the decision, because you are the chair of the session. Okay. But what I am saying is I want to recognize that actually the resort to the Constitution, in which everybody has equal voice, does not obtain in this moment, in this context, at this time. These voices have different weight, different histories, and there is a great deal of fraught contestation about who we are not. That is why this is on the brink. Okay. Right. Well, but if we recognize that, we might be able to go forward.
Well, I agree with the Vice Chancellor's position.
Okay. But
I've
us...
Got,
okay.
We've got
we
a very...
Are going to,
you see, sorry, can I just say something? We've got a... I think this is reflective of precisely the difficulty that we're encountering in South Africa at this moment in time. Let's be all honest about this. There is a great deal of pain legitimately because of 300 years of racist rule. There is a sense in which white people, I'll be quite frank about it, use terms which they bandy around, which only exacerbate hurt. I mean, but on the other hand, part of the point about speech is that people do say things which to a large degree we don't like.
Okay.
And if we're going to actually now start saying you can speak and you can't speak, where do we get to? You can't have a think fest. And so my own view about it is I thought what Mr. Oppenheimer had to say was most unfortunate, to be perfectly blunt, and only makes it worse. But on the other hand, he's got to have some right to say something. I don't know what he wants to say.
No, nobody's
going to give him a right to say.
But he's explicitly offending
How do you know what he's going to say? He may agree with you.
He said it already.
Hold on, guys. Okay.
But you accept
the
following.
Let's hear from Lindsay.
Well, hang on a minute. I'm chairing this, you aren't.
Sorry.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
I'm trying to with Dennis.
I
would like to.
Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. I think it would be utterly unsatisfactory to end it on this basis. And I think I'm going to give you an opportunity to say what you want to say. And I'm going to hopefully there are other people who want to speak. I can see, and I will give you a chance. But I really think it would be, to actually just walk away now is just not good enough.
Yeah. Yes.
Right? We've got to sort this country's mess out, and you don't do it by simply walking away. And I'm not going to walk away. Right? So, yes, please speak.
So, I want us to understand something very beautiful is happening right now. It seems like we only have two options. Yes, thank you for saying that. One. And the one option that we do have is to throw around things that safeguard the status quo. And the status quo is anti-black. At a constitutional level, in terms of the land, and in terms of this person sitting here. So it means this, that no matter what we say, it is reduced to an unfortunate set of words that were used. It's reduced. His whole existence, it plays out black oppression. It plays out...
Didn't you hear what he said? That, he was
that is your white privilege that gives you the opportunity to interrupt me. Yes. Now you wait. Yes. It's 2016.
I'd like you to finish.
I am. I will finish.
Please.
But I will not be stopped. Thank you. Now we have it comes to a point here. It's a nice moment in history, 2016. It's good to be alive. You see, for all our lives,
When people like you use your white privilege, your white power, and use circumstances to still be allowed to speak. 2016, know this. It's done. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen before this. It's done. Your time is up. You must accept it. It's hard, I know. This is what it means to decolonize. The norms of society that give you privilege are done. We are coming for your land. It's done. And your voice right now will not be heard in the space because you are violent. I'm done.
All right, so that's quite the clip. Just explain the voices that sort of would have been heard there for people who weren't there or don't know more about the situation.
So Judge Dennis Davis was chairing the panel, and he's the one who asked me for my name. Lindsay Marsdorp, who's a representative of Black First Land First, is the person you can hear shouting me down for about a minute and a half. And then Anthea Garman is the convener of ThinkFest, who takes this very bewildering line that the Constitution doesn't pertain in this space. And this space, of course, is a university setting called ThinkFest, where it's meant to be about interrogating ideas. And so as uncomfortable as it was to have Lindsay shout me down like that and to take quite a radical stance on many issues. So a few days after this incident, the Dallas shooter went and shot a whole bunch of white police officers specifically to kill white police officers and was then himself killed. Lindsay released a statement saying that we must recognize this man as a martyr, a glorious martyr for our cause, and that it's not enough to moralize and immediately to speak about racial injustice. You need to do something like this brave hero, and that for the next month they plan on starting off with a dedication to him because they see him as this righteous entity. Mm. So you're kind of talking about someone who, you know, has a lot in common with jihadists. Mm. So as worrying as that is, what worries me more is someone like Anthea Garman, who lectures journalism, who, funnily enough, signed a statement condemning the firing of SABC journalists. And in that statement, she talks about how dangerous it is to shut down democratic debate, to shut down free speech. And, you know, and the statement says that it's important for people not to be silenced and for them to think in terms of constitutional norms like free speech. So, you know, you're talking about someone who's clearly conflicted when it comes to the values of the Constitution and thinks they pertain in some spaces and not others.
Yeah.
And that's not how the Constitution works.
Yeah.
The Constitution operates with everyone inside the country, citizen and non-citizen.
So you stand up, you make a tongue-in-cheek joke, basically. You have no relation to those Oppenheimers or those ones, the mining ones, or do you?
So I get asked this on a regular basis. I think from, you know, it's a sort of question that I've I get so often that I have a little card that I print. So when someone asks me the question, I hand them the card. And the question says, are you related to the Oppenheimers? And it says, no, they're related to me.
Wonderful. All right. So, but regardless, it doesn't mean you have any less right whether you are literally the son of the sort of a patriarch or not.
Sure. And there's an ambiguity in what's said in that statement. So I could have been someone like Sarah Godsall. Okay. Mm-hmm. So her father's Bobby Godsall, incredibly wealthy guy, involved in mining. And she could have started off by saying, well, yes, of that Godsall family. And, you know, if given the chance, would have went on to eviscerate herself and say how guilty she feels about her whiteness and her wealth and how she wrote a very famous poem.
She's not
about
giving any of it up, but she's very guilty.
Very guilty. Well, funny enough, so Ivo Fechter wrote recently about an incident that he was involved in. It's an unbelievably important piece entitled The Death of Racial Reconciliation.
Yeah, I think it's one of the pieces of the year, actually.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely superb, yeah. I've read it numerous times.
Yeah, and he says a couple of prescient things. One of the things that – so Sarah says, you know, when asked, you know, do you think the Godsall should give up their property, she says, yes, undoubtedly. And the person from Moses Fall says, that's not good enough because psychologically I want the pleasure of taking it from you.
Yeah.
So, and you know, she writes this poem about, you know, her white flesh should be stripped from her, her white bones should be ground to dust. So, you know, someone who's filled with a lot of self-loathing. Mm. And so, you know, maybe that's where my comment could have been read like that. If I'd been asked, what do you mean by that? We could have had a discussion and we wouldn't have had to have this.
You never get to ask your question in the end. What was your question?
So my question's a technical question. So given that Judge Davis heads up the Tax Commission, that he's aware of the budgetary constraints that we have in the country. He projects that in order to have total free tertiary education, we need to have 150 billion rand a year. Now, he says, let's say we took radical measures. We push up the highest tax rate from 40% to 55%. We push up company tax from 29% to 40%. Okay. He says, that's going to raise you 12 billion rand. Okay. You're still very short. Where's the rest of the money coming from? So my question would have been to address that, to say, well, would you, how much would you want to allocate to higher education? Where are you going to take it from? So are we going to, you know, we're going to take money from our hospitals, got people dying in hospital beds. Do we let more people die in hospital beds? Do we take people's, you know, free housing away? Do we defund the police? Do we defund the public, you know, public wage bill, you know, and so that, you know, the civil servants are getting paid quite well, you know, should we take some money from them?
Because taxation is only anywhere close to the 150 billion.
Yeah. So this is something that has to be faced. The other question would have been to the Vice Chancellor to say, well, what measures are currently being taken to assist poor students? Because there's this idea that no one gets to go to university for free, which is just not the case. So if you earn under a certain, if your family earns under a certain threshold, you get to go to university for free. And there are, you know, merit scholarships and needs-based scholarships. Universities do a lot to assist those that, that don't have. And it's this sort of excluded middle.
So does the private sector as well. There are several sort of private funds and scholarships, bursaries, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. So my question would have been that sort of technical question. And I think it's a question that people shy away from. They don't like to talk about numbers. They don't want to be specific. But it's the question that ultimately has to be grappled with. Because if you care about something like education, which I care very deeply about, and it is one of those things that when you invest in people by giving them a good quality education, not a crap, you know, print-at-home degree, they're able to generate a lot of wealth.
Yeah, absolutely.
That wealth can trickle down to their families and to their dependents. So it is worth doing, but you have to do this costing analysis. And so that's the question I don't get to ask.
So, I mean, based on that clip, is it any wonder that journalism is such a fuck-up as it is now? If you got people like Andrea teaching it, who don't understand the fundamentals of the Constitution, first, the legal framework under which we live. She doesn't understand about the universal principle of law of general application. You know, a law applies to everyone. And thirdly, it's a social justice bullshit, right? And then we wonder why we got, excuse me, think pieces in the Mail and Guardian about utter nonsense. But, I mean, journalism has become a huge opinion piece. It's a huge circle jerk of people who are very self-important and who believe that they are correct about things.
It's what I've said before, which is instead of reporting on the news, they create the news.
Well, they become the news. And then we've got fucking famous, well, not famous, we got celebrities who are journalists, right? Because they write very wittily.
So I think there's a whole bunch of reasons for why we have this state of affairs. One of which is that to do investigative journalism costs money. So you've got to go and send reporters out to gather facts, to be on the ground. It's much cheaper to have someone sit behind their laptop and spout opinion. So, you know, we've moved in this direction globally. So you're finding, you know, Slate, generally, if you look at it as, you know, as a publication that generally runs opinion pieces, you know, you have someone else do the news coverage and then you go and write about what it means.
Yeah, but the New York Times is also filled with this garbage.
Sure.
And still referred to as some sort of doyen of journalism. And frankly, there's a whole bunch of rubbish in there.
Well, it's become hard to make a buck as a publication.
Sure.
So because news is free and no one wants to pay for news, it's going to change the kind of news that you get access to. So that's a concern. I think also that regressives have done an amazing job of capturing these institutions. So think about something like the Daily Maverick. Okay, when it launches, you know, it's meant to be for those that...
Well, let me give you their exact launch statement. The exact launch statement was for people with money and brains. That was their logo/motto. I know this because I was around at the time. I was very interested in the Daily Maverick. I thought it was a great idea. I found the people contributing to it to be enlightening. And I got very involved, tried to get very involved with it, attended their first gathering, that type of stuff. And that was who they were selling to. And then at some point...
So the slogan has changed to people with no money and no brains.
Basically, yeah. But I don't think they'll admit that. But at some point it gets hijacked. The entire sort of system gets hijacked. And now we have essentially what was probably could have become the first kind of conservative...
Classically liberal.
I use conservative in the same way someone like Franz Kronier would use conservative,
right?
In a positive sense.
kind of publication, it's essentially become a very left-leaning one. I mean, you mentioned Abba Vector. He is essentially the only guy left there who seems to write sense. Justin as well has a column occasionally.
But it becomes more insidious because the Daily Maverick have the gathering, the Daily Maverick gathering, and it's one of the premier events where politicians and people in the public sphere can actually meet private individuals and talk things about things publicly. The problem is not them. The problem is that the interviewer on the other side, they are all inherently insipid. All of them. They are journalists, but they don't know anything about policy or externalities of policy or anything like that. So they can kiss Julius Malema's ass for 20 minutes, but you won't get anything of value from it. Because the interviewers don't know anything. That's the problem. They know the inner machinations and who's fighting with who and who's fucking who in the ANC, but they have no idea what the
basic economics works.
The consequences of minimum wage or something like that. And they keep inviting fucking Zwelinzima Mavavi, like the worst person in the world who's never done anything right. Every prediction he's made and every person he supported has fucked him over. And he keeps getting invited.
It's not only a South African problem. So you see it happening in the States. If you look at the current election cycle, you know, you've got a candidate like Trump who has no policy positions and is not being called out for it.
Well, they change every 5 minutes. There are policies.
There's some policy positions that they do change.
Five times a day.
Sure, and if their policies, they're very narrow. So if as a woman you get an abortion, you should be locked up and then you shouldn't, you know, or we should build a massive wall. But, you know, it's basically like whatever policy you can think of, it'll be amazing. It'll be fantastical.
It'll be great. I can't do that.
And he's good at getting away with this because you don't have journalists, you know, taking to task. So I'm hoping that, you know, in the election debates, in the general election, you're going to find, you know, someone strong saying, hold on a sec, you haven't answered my question. You haven't given us any detail here. And you can point out the foolish in that manner. And that's a concern. If you don't have robust journalism, you know, you allow maniacs to, you know, to run rampant.
Okay, so getting back to kind of you, this happens. That's the clip everyone heard. It goes on for quite a bit. You subsequently don't get to ask your question. The whole thing ends at some point.
So what happens is during the conversation, the mic gets taken from me. Eventually, a few questions are allowed, and then it wraps up. And I had a strong sense of fear at the time. I thought, you know, this crowd of people around me may very well lynch me. And so I wrote an article about it for two publications. The one is The Rational Standard, which is a publication that's run by a bunch of youngsters.
Well, that is our only conservative publication.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they're libertarians. They're, you know, avowedly care about inviolate freedom and take that stance. And then Politics Web syndicated the article. And so when I wrote the article, it's the Politics Web one is called You Don't Have the Right to Speak. I take an extract from another publication that wrote about the event, a publication called Black Opinion. Mm-hmm. And in that piece, firstly, they call the Vice Chancellor House Negro. They say that
you're talking about Jonathan Johnson.
No, this was the Vice Chancellor of Rhodes, Dr. Mabusela.
Oh, yes.
Who speaks up, you know, very favorably in favor of free speech. Mm. And so they say when the race war comes, it'll be blacks like this who are standing in front of their white master saying, please don't kill master. We must be wary of these blacks. They call Dennis Davis a white liberal racist. And then they say that Oppenheimer should have been shumbocked by the crowd, and it's a great injustice that the crowd was too meek to have inflicted that upon him. He should have been attacked and brutalized.
Who wrote this or who said this?
The site is called blackopinion.co.za, okay. And so I have a link to it in the article. So now on some level – well, this is an interesting moment for me. So, I gave this earlier example about the kinds of speech that ought to be allowed. So, as a liberal, I'll say that I will fight to the death for your right to disagree with me. Hmm. And as much as I don't like this comment being said about me, for it to be said in that forum, in other words, on a website, perfectly acceptable to my mind. Hmm. It would have been different if it had been shouted out in that audience,
in that moment,
and the mob had risen up.
So if we'd added to that sort of what Marstorp was saying, if you just added "let's shambok him," that would have been problematic. That would have been an incitement to violence right there.
Sure, sure.
And that would be, let's not use the word problematic, that would be a huge issue.
Well, it's unlawful, and unlawful. It would be unlawful. It
would be, that's an example of non-protected speech. But here what you have is a call for violence.
Yeah.
But a call for violence of an event that's already passed. So what they're saying is you ought to have reacted like this.
So they should be able to say that.
Sure. There's an argument that you might say, in other words, when this event arises again, the implicit assumption is that's when you whip out your Schambach and you start beating people.
But isn't this the sort of discussion Ramon and I've had before, which is, you know, if you're a free speech absolutist, and I've said where the caveats to my feeling on this is, unless you're standing in front of the baying mob, then say whatever you like. Even saying, you know, we should be violent to a thing that hasn't happened yet, might happen, might not happen. People have a lot of time. I mean, that essentially almost becomes premeditated. If you attend an event in a year's time and people Schambach you, that means that they have been premeditating that thought. And, you know, if they were to murder you, that would be premeditated murder. That's on the individual responsibility.
And you could punish that. I also think, so the imminency is taken out of the situation. You know, that there's, you know, when it's, there's no threat of imminent violence when it's written on a website. So that's why, you know, I'm okay with the speech being out there. And there's a reason also why I quote that in my article. I want people to know what views are out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can shine some reason on it. People can look and go, wow, that's terrifying. That's something we need to be aware of.
Yeah. So with regards to, because this got thrown in my face recently, the Rwanda example, and you'd mentioned it a little bit earlier, the initial sort of thing that goes, you know, kill all – I can't remember if it was Tutsis, Hutus, but kill all of these people. The initial thing, that's allowed, not allowed.
So I think
It becomes actually violent, or you see people reacting to it, you stop it then. Where's the sort of line there?
So it's a hard question to answer because we know it occurred. So, but what you might find is that once it becomes evident that people are acting on the speech and that you don't have a justice system that's operating that's going to stop those people. So you can say, well, look, in an ideal democratic society with the functioning state, when people, you know, act violently, well, then we send in the police. But if you don't have that, you know, if your state is failing and you've got someone on the radio calling for the death of neighbors, to my mind, it seems perfectly legitimate to go and block those radio signals because those radio signals are playing a direct role in the deaths of a million people.
For which you're not going to be able to do anything about.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Because after the Dallas shooting of the cops, a lot of Black Lives Matter supporters on Twitter were saying, yeah, one dead pig is fantastic. They should have killed more. Next time you see a pig, shoot him in the face. They even had a protest in the middle of the street. It was pigs in a blanket, smoking like bacon or something. Something about pigs and police.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, I don't know if it's true. Does the U.S. have a hate speech provision?
So America wouldn't have the kind of thing that we – the limitation that we have.
Right.
There's a very famous case in the States about a little town in Illinois called Skokie. And a group of Nazis decide they're going to have a rally in Skokie. Skokie is a town with a small number of Jews in it, some of whom are Holocaust survivors. And they object to having this march. It's incredibly insensitive and hurtful and painful for them to see guys carrying swastikas in their town, and they feel threatened by it. And the question becomes, should they be allowed to march? And so the Supreme Court of Appeal adjudicates on the matter and says, yes.
They should be allowed.
Let these guys march. They are hateful, repugnant. These are some of the worst members of society, but let them march so we can look at that and we can see them. And as much as it'll cause offense and discomfort and emotional hurt, there's going to be no physical violence. There's going to be no financial harm. At the moment at which any of these guys start attacking, you know, a synagogue or doing anything like that, then you can constrain them.
Yeah.
And so that's the line that America has taken.
And that's the maturity I was talking about earlier. Just on the false sort of equivalency that's – I just remember where that example came from. Someone had said, you know, that it was excellent Milo had been banned from Twitter because he's if I just read it for you exactly – he was being downright abusive. This was with regards to Leslie Jones, I think it was. And I said that words can't hurt you. And someone else sort of responded, you know, yes, they can. And words are bad or something. And I replied to this, the effect of, you know, definitely words are wanted by The Hague for crimes against humanity. They brought up the example, oh yeah, but you know, war crimes start with words, you know, like Rwanda. So that was the example. I just, it's
It's unfortunate the reasoning and the poor logic that gets us to that kind of point from somewhere completely different.
So that's why it's important for us to be clear about what we mean when we talk about hateful speech and hate speech. So that hate speech that is going to incite violence is dangerous. And I think there are good reasons to stop that kind of speech. Mm. The problem is when we conflate the two.
Mm. So the Equality Court, we've conflated the two, no?
So this is what's interesting about the legislation is so it enlarges the ambit dramatically. So it talks about hurtful speech. It enlarges the number of categories that could be targeted. So it imports those from Section 9, the equality section of the Constitution. So it includes disability, pregnancy, age, sexual orientation. And so there's an interesting moral debate to be had about whether those are things that ought to be given protection in addition to race, ethnicity, and religion. But the Constitution is pretty clear. It limits it to those four grounds. But the legislation itself says that, you know, speech will be allowed, and it makes reference to Section 16 of the Constitution about free speech. So it's sort of, there's an inherent contradiction in the legislation itself.
Never been challenged, of course.
It hasn't been, and I think it's ripe for challenge. I think it's important that people test these things out. So if you look at what happens with Penny Sparrow, she's fined 150,000 rand. It's done in via default judgment process because she doesn't go and defend the matter. So no counter argument is given. One of the reasons that she says is that no one was willing to defend her. So this is the concern. So there's a famous case about a baby that was raped in Uitenhaag. The play Tsapung is based on this true fact. And six guys were rounded up and arrested for it. And the papers in the newspaper, the pictures are in the newspaper, and everyone says, look at these guys, they look like rapists, scum of the earth. And no one wants to defend them. And someone steps forward and says, I think everyone is entitled to,
which is the basic tenet of the law.
Yeah, and so he steps forward and he says, I will risk my status in the legal community and I will defend you. And in the defense, it turns out that they did a little bit of DNA testing. Wasn't these guys. Innocent. So this is the danger, that when people aren't given access to a fair trial and no one wants to stand up for those that are viewed by society as despicable, we don't get to just results. Now, I don't want to endorse the content of what Penny Sparrow is saying, but it would be nice for that idea to be tested in a court. And I think it's important for our constitutional court to look at what are the limits of free speech. You know, is something like the Equality Act going too far on the dignity side as opposed to the freedom side? And so have some good jurisprudence come out of it.
In terms of – I hate digging up Penny Sparrow, but in terms of what she said, if we just go to the Constitution, it doesn't violate any one of those things you listed, as far as I can tell.
So here's a –
Please don't take that out of context to mean I agree with what she said.
Yes. So this is the interesting thing, why people find liberalism such a strange view. Is, so I said earlier that, you know, I will fight to the death for your right to disagree with me. People say, but that's bizarre. How could you want to allow someone a space to say ideas that are different to yours? Because we care about principles, right? So we don't have to endorse the content of speech to think that free speech is important. You know, part of why we think that free speech is important is that it allows all these ideas that we disagree with, these, you know, supposedly repugnant ideas, to be expressed. And maybe it turns out that when people say, you know, we ought to abolish slavery, people say, that's a repugnant idea. We've had slavery for generations. How can you dare say something like that?
Let's allow gay marriage. How can you allow that? Marriage isn't between a man and a woman.
Exactly. It's disgusting. It's an offensive idea to express. So that's why it's important for us to say, hey, maybe we're sometimes mistaken about the true state of moral affairs. Let's debate this in the marketplace. So, all right. So what Penny Sparrow says is, black people are like monkeys. Okay. So it's a racist trope. And she sort of says, you know, they've littered this beach, and she expresses this hateful idea. How someone responds to it is interesting. So there's a guy, Velapi, who says, we need to rise up and do to white people what Hitler did to the Jews. Okay. So here's this amazing example where you get to test out hate speech and hateful speech. So you've got a call to action here. He's saying, let's have a white genocide. Let's go out and exterminate these people. It's very clear what he's saying. So, and for whatever reason, you don't have the same level of outcry. You know, Velapi's name is not mentioned when we talk about racists.
I remember the incident. I didn't even remember the name.
Velapi Khumalo, he got suspended from the ANC, by the way.
Okay. So they did.
Some action was taken.
Good for them.
But that's actually a good point. So Penny was hateful speech. Velapi was hate speech.
Yes.
And I mean, that's the difference. It's a call to action to do an act that harms others, whereas Penny is just bigotry, really, if you
sure.
put it that way.
I like
she didn't
to think
say,
of it as,
you know, exterminate the monkeys, right? She didn't exactly. say anything like that.
It's also, it's tiny racism, right? So when you hear her explanations for it, she sort of says, oh, I don't hate black people, and, you know, like,
I love monkeys.
Yeah, and I'm into them in a cute fruit. Way.
And call children monkeys and things
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
So she's clearly not a person. She's not Adolf Hitler, right?
No.
You know, so, and she's been made out to be that way. So that's why that charitable approach is important, to say, hold on a sec. That's pretty offensive. I feel hurt by what you've said, but explain it a bit more.
Yeah.
You know? Or you can advise someone, like, just be aware of what you're saying. That's very different to saying, thou shalt not speak ever, you know. And what we've created this climate of absolute fear. So someone like Shapiro draws on this quite old trope. And I understand why people are unaware of the trope, because it's a, when was the last time you were walking down the street and you saw
an organ grinder.
And saw an organ grinder and a monkey, right? It's, you know, it's an old thing. Cartoonists have been using it. There was a contemporaneous cartoon with Donald Trump playing the organ and the media as the monkey. You know, I get that the thing has a different symbolic meaning here, but if people had paused and said, what do you mean by this, Shapiro? You know, he wouldn't have said, oh, I want to say that all black people are monkeys because I've shown Sean Abrams as, you know, as a monkey, and I think all monkeys ought to be exterminated. He'd say, well, this is the meaning of the symbol that I've used, and it's about a power relationship and a control and how the NPA is being controlled by Zuma. An important statement out there, that's, you know. And, of course, instead of talking about, you know, the lack of independence of the NPA, we end up talking about, you know, racist speech.
Is it the correct metaphor to use, knowing very well that it could be deemed racist? Like, that's what people are asking.
It's all this thing about sensitivities, you know?
Right.
Who gives a shit about sensitivities? You don't have a right not to be offended. Like,
yeah.
So if you're sensitive about something, be sensitive about something. That's nice. You know, then you censor yourself. Don't read something that you might find offensive. Don't look at stuff. Block yourself off from those things.
Sure. Well, you can alert people to the fact that I find this offensive. But so Gareth Van Onselen wrote this fantastic piece a couple of weeks ago where he, because he's such a great researcher, you know, he'll trawl through publications over the last 15 years and show incidences where politicians have used animal traps. So he cites the 10 best animal traps and where people have been called snakes and hyenas and monkeys and baboons, you know, from different racial spectrums, from different political parties. You know, it's part of the metaphorical language that is used in our country and around the world by, you know, referring to someone like an animal. So, you know, to say there's a history of people being called like an animal and it sort of makes them subhuman,
yeah.
It's context dependent, you know, it's important to look at
that. But even in local context, right, I think in Zulu, if you call someone a snake, like it means he's shifty, you know, don't
sure.
trust him. Like it's indigenous as well.
He talks about the series of ads that Eskom ran, talking about people that steal cables and they refer to them as snakes.
Yes, well, what are they called? There's a particular Izongna, anyway. I can't remember, but there's a term for them.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, cable thieves. But sorry, Mark, just to find, okay, last 2 minutes.
Bullshit.
No.
we'll go on a little bit.
Oh,
longer.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I want to talk about so-called Islamophobia in Europe, and just bear with me. So there is a lot of immigration into Europe now from Syria, from Islamic countries, and a lot of people on the left and a lot of the politicians are saying, you know, these people are refugees. We can't not allow them in, especially in the EU. And other people that say, well, we're a bit worried about Islam, especially political Islam, because it's not really, it clashes with our laws, right? Sharia law and child brides and whatever. Doesn't work very well.
Honor killings.
These people are shunned. And, you know, they're called Islamophobes and racist and little Britons and whatever the case might be. So they are kept quiet by the media and intellectuals and politicians. The problem with that is by silencing them and by not allowing them to say that they are worried about immigration, because there are economic reasons why you should be wary of immigration as well, especially as a blue-collar worker, of course. But by silencing them, you're giving a lot of power to the far right. So they're not going to express the displeasure in speech because they get shut down. But they will do so in voting. And who are they going to vote? They're going to vote for the mortal enemy of the very people who are censoring them. Who's only Marine Le Pen is saying, the jihadis are coming here and killing our priests in our churches. This is ridiculous. We must rise up and do something. No one else has said that. But
it's of grave concern. I mean, you pointed out so well that when you suppress speech, what happens is that people's avenues for dissent get limited, and they end up picking these far-right candidates.
Indeed.
So guys, you know, guys that are supporting Trump feel like, you know, regressive movements aren't allowing us to say what we want, so let's bring in someone who will bring some law and order, you know, so we'll vote for Trump or we'll vote for Brexit, you know.
And I think it's even more, it speaks to that point around, you know, Justin McCarthy went into this in terms of polling. Voting is a secret thing very often, something very personal at least to most people. So I think what you're seeing as the Trump supporters in America isn't even the half of it. I think all the kind of people who've been shut down, who actually don't really like Trump, think he goes a step too far in many of his views, are probably going to put an X next to his name. For this exact reason.
Yeah, but the point I was trying to make, which flows from yours, is that by censoring people, you're giving them a lot of ammunition to use in various ways that you can't predict or see.
So I think it's important if you have this space where you can express radical ideas in a forum, and they can be interrogated.
Well, even personally, even reasonable ideas at
sure.
this moment.
Yeah. You know. So, you know, when someone says, you know, those immigrants are going to steal our jobs, right? What you want to be able to do is interrogate that idea properly and say, okay, instead of me just calling you a bigot, let's have a look at the underlying assumption here. Let's look at the data. You know, so you can see that actually immigration is one of these things that's quite good for economies. You know, America is a nation founded upon immigrants.
Yes.
My grandparents were refugees. They fled Nazi Germany. You know, they came here and they, you know, built up a life for themselves.
Well, that does allow for the nuances, though, as well, because, you know, the statement that immigrants will steal our jobs has elements of truth to it, and there's quite a lot of falsity in there. But if you look at what, you know, someone like Dan Hannan in the UK would have said with regards to immigration for Brexit, is not that he's against immigration, he's against unfettered immigration. They want to let in people who are going to contribute to their society. And most countries do this, most first world countries. You can't just walk into their country. That's why you have to send them all your sort of educational background, who you are, what you do, if you've got a criminal record, etc. It makes sense to most people that, yes, immigrants who are functioning members of a society are contributing members of a society, whereas those who fundamentally hate what you stand for may very well not be good for you.
So I think you can draw the following distinction. The first is on your general policy regarding immigration, which I think it makes sense to say we ought to be we should try and attract the best and the brightest, and that you have very good reason to exclude those that hate your society and, you know, want to destroy it. But that's a particular kind of immigration policy for general situations. The other one is when you've got a refugee crisis. So when you've got people that are being massacred from both sides in Syria, when you've got, you know, ISIS killing them and you've got Assad killing them, you know, these are people saying, we're not the radicals you are afraid of. Those are the guys who are killing us, you know, and we just need temporary refuge. You know, people sort of think about, you know, you look at Germany in 1939, you've got Jews that are being persecuted, and you've got nations closing their doors. People look at them and they say, but how? How is that possible? How could we allow 6 million people to be exterminated? You know, how could people be so callous? And now you face a similar situation. You just got a different group of people that are, you know, people are fearful of and hateful of. And I think it's important to recognize that you've got people that are under enormous pressure, who could do with refuge, that they're not saying we want to join your country forever. We need it now because Syria is in massive crisis. And I think it's important on humanitarian grounds to take that into consideration.
Absolutely.
And the problem is that the fearmongers are good at sort of saying, you know, don't allow these guys to come in, and, you know, they're very dangerous. And of course, you can have vetting procedures. It's important to sort of work out, well, we don't want, you know, ISIS agents, you know, slipping in amongst the refugees. But when you do a rational analysis of it, you find, well, actually, it's easier for those guys to come in on a visa. You know, it's a very dumb idea for them to try and smuggle themselves in with the refugees. The chances of getting caught in that process are much higher. But what's important about having the free speech arena open is that we can discuss the ideas, and let the truth sort of shine in. As soon as we silence and say, you can't say that, that's bigoted, that's hateful, and people just don't feel like they can express the idea, then we miss out on opportunities for getting good answers.
Right, but then we leave the door open for them to take actions in other ways,
exactly.
i.e. voting for Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen or whoever. It becomes a cultural vote, not a policy vote in a way.
Sure.
It becomes a vote that's, it's a protectionist vote, right? That's the real Little Britain mentality. So I'll vote for someone who says, these people are evil. I also think they're evil. And I don't want my job to be taken away from me, to be given to someone who hasn't contributed their fair share or whatever.
Sure.
Whatever.
What's interesting when you look at it, so immigrants don't tend to take jobs often. They tend to go and start their own businesses. So, indeed. And they end up employing people.
Indeed. It depends on the immigrant, though.
Sure.
Yeah.
Jews, Poles, Sikhs, Pakistanis, a lot of – they are stereotypes, of course, but these people do very well. Koreans,
Cambodians,
do extremely well. Yeah. Cambodians, extremely well.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right.
And they provide a richness of ideas as well. People come from their countries. They – you know, I mean, one of the reasons why America is such a wonderful place to be is because you've got these people from all these different contexts, you know, bringing their ideas with them and, you know, the kind of this intellectual diversity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree generally with that. I'm a little bit more protectionist on the sort of Syrian situation because I do think, as you say, the vetting, for example, is important. I think it was that guy, the axe murderer in Germany, the guy who got on the train and butchered a whole bunch of people with an axe.
And the machete guy who killed a pregnant woman. He was an asylum seeker who was rejected from Germany but was not deported.
The axe guy, I think, was a Pakistani faking being an Afghan.
Oh, right.
So, so you see, this is the issue. And the problem is when we sweep these things under the rug, it only sort of highlights the problem. You only need one incident then to make the sort of fearmongers seem 100% correct and give them so much credibility when, you know, the middle road approach would be far, far better. I want to end off on a sort of high notes, because after that conversation where you weren't allowed to ask a question, you were completely censored, shouted down, pretty aggressive sort of scenario and situation, you then sort of went and spoke to everyone afterwards, and just tell us a bit about that experience.
So I thought it was important to have a conversation that's one-on-one, that's not in this grandstanding arena. So I went to Lindsay Marsdorp and I said to him, Lindsay, you and I aren't representatives of our races. We're individuals. We're human beings. And we can have a conversation. And I could see that the fire in his eyes had sort of drained, that he wasn't in front of this crowd. He's an excellent orator. I mean, you sort of, you know, you can see the rhetoric sort of coming out of him. But one-on-one, much calmer guy. And we had a conversation. We, you know, we sort of debated ideas. We ended up having a glass of wine together. We shook hands, you know.
We didn't agree with each other.
We didn't agree with each other, and that's okay. We don't have to agree with each other. You know, the vice chancellor came up to me and he held my hand and he apologized. He said, I'm sorry, we couldn't have a free debate at Rhodes, and this is a great shame. I had a long chat with Judge Davis, and I had a long chat with Anthea Garman. And it's important to be able to do this. You know, one of the things that Ivo writes about so well is this reconciliation, this being able to take disparate groups, people with different ideas, and getting them to forgive each other and act charitably towards each other, and how we've lost that. And one of the things that he writes about so well, he says, he's going through university between 89 and 92. You can see that the country is on the edge of a race war. You can see that, you know, it's a precipice. There's killings going on in KwaZulu. There's an enormous amount of tension. And what the constitutional dispensation is about at the time is saying, anyone who wants to participate in this process and building this new constitutional order can partake, provided you agree to be peaceful. And you have this negotiated process, and you wind up having this constitution that's built on reconciliation. And what's interesting is now that when people are part of that born free generation, they didn't see the transition. So I think that's why there's this disjunct with this current generation of guys at university who say, we were sold out. You know, this constitution isn't worth anything. Mandela is a traitor. They didn't see the risk that was faced. So you and I grew up at a time, you know, I was 11 in 94. So it becomes a formative value for you, you know, to sort of say, this is important, to forgive each other, to have a TRC where, you know, the truth comes out and we say, we don't like what you did, but we're not going to, you know, we're not going to execute you for it. It's a difficult thing for us to have. It's actually, when people talk about Ubuntu and African values, this is a very African value, this idea of reconciliatory justice, of looking each other in the eye and saying, I don't like what you did, but we have to live together and we're going to make this work. And I think that's important. We need to have a space where we allow speech, and we don't have to, you know, we don't have to shout each other down and silence each other just because we don't like what the other person has to have, what they have to say.
Absolutely. I think the 94 consensus is worth fighting for. As I said on Twitter numerous times, it's the founding principle of this country, post-94. Don't let these privileged little race baiters, you know, destroy it for us.
Mark, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. It's been excellent.
Can you be found? Do you want to be found? Social media?
So I don't have a Twitter account, but if you want to...
Lucky man.
If you want to read things that I've written, they're available on Politics Web. I've written for The Citizen as well. A Mark Oppenheimer Google search will lead you to another famous Mark Oppenheimer as a writer, but maybe I'll be found in the dregs somewhere.
Found somewhere in there.
And we'll link the article at the bottom, on Twitter, rather.
All right. As usual, you know where to find us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. Please follow us on Twitter. @renegade_report. If you haven't yet, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also find it on Pocket Cast or on the Cliff Central app. Thank you so much for listening, and we will chat to you next time.
I've got something important to tell you. CliffCentral.com